Dash number 16711, Fred Welsh, reel 9.
Mr. Welsh, reel 9. We were discussing the cookhouse and how it works whilst you're in Iraq, Mr. Welsh. What was the food situation?
Well, the hillside we were camped on, at the bottom of the hill, ran the road on which the Indians did a lot of transport. And we always thought we were on their kind of rations, which was a lot of fish, mackerel and tinned fish. And you can imagine where we were, fresh vegetables were rather unknown. But we got the usual army food, and the lad we had at Cook did a very good job. We'd had trouble once before. There was once an occasion when the officer came round asking about the food. This wasn't in Iraq, before Iraq. And we complained. We said all we get is SOS. And he wanted to know what SOS was. And SOS was the same old stew. The outcome of this, they changed cooks. And later, again, he came back, and we still complained, and we said, we're still on SOS. And he says, what, the same old stew? We said, no, not now, Stan Oliver's stew, your new office, your new cook. And the outcome of this again, cooks changed, and this young man who was a from way down Hereford and Wales area, who had quite a few of that lads made our battalion up. And he turned out to be a good cook, coping the stuff he was given. And one meal I must mention, I don't know whether it's in the rail farther back, but Christmas Eve I was fortunate enough to receive a food parcel sent by my sister.
Yes, you did mention that.
I thought we'd mention that, so we'll scrub that. But all in all, the food there was good, and as I say, we got a regular ration of rum at night, which was very good under the conditions.
What kind of activities were you doing there? What were you doing exactly?
An officer called Jackson from Gateshead. I might be wrong, but I think his family owned a pub, what they called the Lang Bar, in Newcastle. And he formed a fighting patrol, which I was nominated to go in. And one of his exercises was, we set off into Iraq and around the hills. We took a tin of corned beef and a few biscuits, and we were going to be self-sufficient. And the idea was we would try and stalk a gazelle, which is a small deer. We did this for 2 days, but we never got anywhere near them to shoot them until one of the best shots in the battalion, a man called Charlie Solis, man who was a gamekeeper in Civilian Street. And he said, well, we cannot chase them. Let me have a go from farther back. And he did manage to shoot a gazelle, injure it, and we managed to catch it and kill it. And we had a meal out of that. And after 2 or 3 days, we came back. Otherwise, you were on guard duty. You went on, you patrolled this bridge, which was about 2 miles down the road. Well, no, it was fortunate or unfortunate, but there, marching home from that one day was the only time I ever had problems marching. And I snapped a shoelace, bootlace, and by the time I got back, I had blood poisoning in my feet. So I missed a lot of duties there. And by now, rumours, which you lived on rumours in the army, were coming that we were due to leave to go back up the desert.
You've mentioned the rain and that you had problems with, the water. What was it like when the snow arrived for you?
Oh, well, it was always cold. As I say, when I hear people talk of Iraq now, I'll say, yeah, the coldest place I ever knew, which rather takes people aback when they hear a statement like that. But it really was bitter, bitter cold.
Keeping warm was a problem, was it?
Oh, it was a big problem, keeping warm. You had to be on the move all the time. The daytime was welcome to be doing hard work to get yourself warmed in training and marching. And the guards, well, standing on guard, it would be terrible at night. Bitter cold. You couldn't keep warm because you had the bridge to guard, there was always a colonel's guard and there was always pickets around the campsite. So, again, your time was filled quite easily with that. And from there, one day, I did get a day out in Kirkwood, courtesy of a poor friend who died. And the padre said it would be a good idea to show the flag and show what a military funeral was. And I was chosen as a bearer for this man. And we took him into Kirkwood and he was given a full military funeral. Shots fired over his graves, the last post sounded, and regimental slow marches, the whole lot through the town. And we were given an hour in KK, but we were never welcome in Iraq, not like other countries. You didn't know who was on the British side or who wanted you out of Iraq. And we all said the sooner this episode came to an end, the better we would all feel.
What was the name of the soldier that you buried?
A lad called Henderson, I think, who came from Concert, who died of a blood disease. He was a motorcycle sergeant in the motorcycle platoon.
Did you have any sport organised amongst yourselves?
Well, it was only football there, because there was no pitches, you just improvised, and as I say, we were in the hills, so there was really no flatland. And you weren't in the mood for a sport as such.
Was boredom a problem? Were you there quite a while?
Yes, boredom was a problem because you never had, not that you ever got much, but you never had the thought in your mind that in a fortnight's time you were going on a weekend pass. So we had something, never had anything to look forward to, like a night out or a 5 days leave or a weekend pass. You just, would just hold it on and on and on.
Did this cause any problems between individuals, temper fraying and so forth?
No, I never knew. I would only say I ever knew of one man who never fit into the platoon. I'll not mention the lad's name as he got killed. But otherwise, you could go out on a guard duty. You could leave what odd money you had on your bed by mistake, or you could leave your cigarettes on the bed. But they'd be there when you went back. That was the quality of our platoon.
You were there at Christmas 1941. What kind of a day was that for you, Christmas Day?
Well, I think if I can remember rightly, the officers did try to come and feed us, which was always an officer's, I don't know whether it was a duty or a tradition, that the officers worked in the mess for the ordinary soldier at Christmas. But really there was nothing, because mail was hard to come by, even parcels were very erratic, and your Christmas boxes didn't arrive. And your pricks, Christmas boxes, when they came, were socks, scarves, balaclavas and the like. You never got a watch, or you never got a box of chocolates, and the Christmas gifts were necessities that you looked and lived for.
You mentioned hunting gazelles. Was there any other wildlife around that was hunted by the, particularly the officers and men?
Well, we didn't know, but there was plenty. If you come across a village, you could guarantee that at the end of the village, somebody would have a chicken in his hand. I don't know how we got it, but we got them, stole them, or bartered for them, something, but we got them. And they weren't plump chickens, they were just little scrags. In the little villages where the little Arabs used to sit and watch you come through and such like, you wondered how they survived.
Have you any other memories of Iraq?
Well, an outstanding one was that when we were in Cyprus, my pal, who we met on the train going to join the DLI, was taken ill with a hernia. But they couldn't operate in Cyprus, so he had to wait until he got onto the mainland, which was Egypt, and report sick. And when they'd got to Egypt to go into Iraq, he just ignored this and didn't go sick. But in Iraq, it flared up and he was taken out, taken to hospital. And that was the last I saw of him until well after the war.
What was his name again?
John Wise, Private John Wise from Darlington. We were always known the three. There was Freddie Wass from Conway, John Wise from Darlington, and me from Ferry Hill. And we were always just mentioned as Wass, Welsh and Wise. That was our, of course, we were always together.
You got promoted in Iraq, is that right?
No, I got promoted up the desert.
When did you receive news that you were leaving Iraq?
Well, about a week before we left, the rumour came that we were to start packing the heavy goods, and that next week would be on the move. And the move again was done by the Royal Service Corps. And the wagons came, and we started our trek back. But this time, at the end of the day, we finished with a route march to the camp. We didn't ride to the camp, which fortunately again I missed, because I was still sick with my feet, and I rode on the, I worked in the cookhouse all the time there, so I missed that. And we came to the usual camps, and
the same route back, was it?
Same road back. There's only one road. Yes.
Did you have any problems with protecting yourselves against thievery from the natives?
The only place there seemed to be trouble was at this big camp called Habania. Apparently, Habania was notorious for losing weapons. So when you went at night in Habania, our camp, we put two tents back to back, bivouacs. There was a guard outside each door, with wagons with the light shining on this door all night long. People on guard at each stroke, and a outside patrol marching around all night. And you got up next morning and a rifle had gone. Somebody had stolen a rifle. and they could never catch these. Must have been the Arabs who were looking for them. Do them no good, just causing problems. And it was rather a long night there, and we were glad to get away from Habania and get on our camps farther down the road.
Have they told you where you were going?
No, no, you never got specific word that you were going then. When we came out of Iraq, again, the pleasure of riding down the escarpment and looking at the green land of the Jordan Valley where all the fruit was, marvellous. And we rode to the railhead, unloaded, and got on the train. And that was when we knew this was the train to go to the far end of the railway. Again, the railhead, because there was a rail up the desert which, every time there was an advance, they advanced the railway a little bit, and it went as far as right to the end of the road, and you got out of there, and again, you got into wagons.
There'd be quite a change in weather from what you'd been leaving to where
yes,
you were going.
Yes.
How did you take to the change?
Well, it was rather a strange, enjoyable journey on the train from into the desert, because wherever you went, you were overwhelmed with sellers selling supposedly diamond rings for about sixpence, fruit, and you paid woodbines for these, or players, or whatever issue you'd had at that particular time, because you got 50 cigarettes issued supposedly every week. But and I always remember a Corporal Foster sat in the train, and they were buying baskets of Jaffas, and all they did was pour them over the top of Pop Robson sat in his carriage. And all you could see was oranges in his head out of the top. And these oranges were bought, as I say, with cigarettes. But when the train moved off, that was when you bought the most, because you got the oranges in, tipped them out, give the lad his basket back, throw the cigarette out, and when the poor lad opened it, there was just an empty cigarette pocket. The same with one, the Sergeant Major. He caught one lad. They were always cutting the glass on the carriages to show that these rings were diamond rings. We kept this poor lad on his train for half a day, wouldn't let him off. How he ever got back to where he belonged, I don't know. But this was how we treat them. We weren't very good with them. And it was right there. Enjoyable episode to get all this fresh fruit. I mean, we lived on Jaffa's here, beautiful. Then we took them right up the desert with us and give them to wagon drivers when we got farther up.
What was the desert like?
Well, it was just a wide expanse into nothingness, and the dust was like a flower, when you see a flower poured into a dish, and it comes up, and that was a sort of dust. It was never a dust that you could escape. It got into everything, your eyes, and the back of wagons used to be terrible, because it churned up into these 30 hundredweight wagons we were stood in. Terrible place to be. And each wagon had a Bren gun on top as anti-aircraft when you rode up the deserts. But when you were attacked, and you were attacked regularly with Stukas, because if anybody walked, you could see the dust for miles behind them. So any movement was picked up miles away, and if there was a convoy in the offing, it was bombed. But the service corps lads, the wagon drivers, had a system. They had the doors off the trucks or the doors fastened back, and they could crash stop a truck and be away from the bombing area. And the one I knew always said, what took me 20 minutes to walk back, I could run in 10 seconds when I was getting stupid. And he used to say, you're no good with them Bren guns, take it from me, seek asylum off the back. Because a Bren gun was useless against an aeroplane.
The journey up the desert, did you see any signs of warfare that had gone on before you?
There was hot wagons laid about and wheels and always good emplacements. But as I say, in the desert, wherever you stopped, wherever they stopped, you had to stop near a water supply. So maybe one day you could travel 100 miles and see nothing, and then all of a sudden you come into an area where there were a few wells, and this was where you found the broken tanks, broken guns, debris of war, empty cans and such like, until we went up and we got into the Gazala line and relayed the 4th Indian Division.
What were your feelings? You must have known now that going into the desert, you're going into a fighting area.
Well, you know, I became a bit apprehensive. How would I act when the war was at my doorstep? And I think I conducted myself very well. And I was only ever really frightened once. Other times I could cope with, as I found, the noise was the as big a problem as what was coming. Shells whistling, artillery fires, tanks firing, wagons rattling about, and you couldn't hear the lad next door without shouting, and that was that's what sticks in my mind. The very first time I saw action, we'd taken over our positions, and whatever position you take off anybody, it's never good enough for the officer that you had. So you picks out, your shovels out, and your camouflages out, and you aligning firing points, Bren gun positions, mortar positions, and they're all to dig. And to dig in the desert, you dug down for about half an inch, and you took a half inch of just like limestone, and that's what it was all the time. There was no such thing as a good dig. And in the end, rather than dig down, whatever you brought out, you built up. So you only dug half a trench. It was half in, and they were named sangas. You were behind these stone parapets. You didn't need camouflaging because it was the desert. It was what you dug out of the desert. And Cooks and such like had pioneers to organise their positions. You had to have, obviously, more camouflage in deeper places, and they use nets and camouflage nets. And each company had its own coke house up the front, and that's one thing, we were never second, we were always the front line, always the point. And you guarded in front of you was usually a minefield. And you knew of them because of maps. There were roads through the minefields, which obviously had to be guarded every night and had to be kept an eye on during the day. Lookouts, as I say, you could say anybody, if a truck moved 2 miles away, you could say the dust. But it just was dust. It wasn't, as I say, a Lawrence of Arabia sand. There was no, I never had to walk in any of that. And
were you wired in as well as mines around you?
No, there was no. Not, we were wires well up at the other side of the minefield. It was wired. And we used to go out one period, we spent a night shift. We went through a minefield for about a mile, and we dug observation posts, which was a rail point, a rail outpost, and it was rather an eerie night, because there you had to use drills, air drills, automatic air drills on a wagon would come up on the compressor, and you had these going all night. Well, you can imagine the night, what the night was like with these drills hammering away, and the Germans are in as near as what your own lads were at the back. But nothing ever happened to that. We were quite fortunate there. They never attacked us at night.
What was life like in the box? You've touched upon some of it, of course. The static position, you couldn't move very far.
Well, you couldn't move far. Your daytime lasted from 2:30 in the morning till the last stand to at 11 o'clock at night. And if you were lucky enough not to have a duty after 11 o'clock at night, you slept in your trench, but you could be, you were just laid in your trench, and somebody was stood on in the parapet keeping his eyes and his ears open, and you were always waking up every 2 to 4 hours, 6 hours to do your stint on stag, as we call it, guard duty. And really, days were very, very long. Stand two was at dawn and stand two was at dusk. And the sun used to rise about 6 o'clock in the morning and set at 9 o'clock at night. And the heat and the flies is nobody's business. Whenever you got a meal, you went down to the cookhouse and carried your Dixie back to your area, and again you just sat in your trench. But you were absolutely in a cloud of flies when you were eating your meal. And if the flies weren't getting their share, the sand was covering what you had left. Especially the regular sweet, as we call it, was rice. You never got white rice, it was always brown rice by the time you got the thing. And another thing, I was very, very rough 2 hours. But I was privileged to see a woman. And we were sat watching an on duty one night, and in the distance was this wall of sand, a mile long and about 100 foot high. Whether my pronunciation's right or not, but it was called a Kamsing. And when this arrived, there were the wind in them, there were petrol tins, there were water bottles, just rattled along like feathers. And you wore your gas mask, you wore your goggles, you put your cape on, you put your gas cape on, and just hoped this would leave. A marvellous thing to say, but not a marvellous thing to be in.
What was the water problem you did have? A bit of a ration there, didn't you?
While we were rationed, it wasn't a problem. The thing was, there wasn't any. You've got a bottle for the day. And out of this, the cook had to have some, you had to wash, and you had to shave, and have a little drink. But it was forever tepid. Awful to drink. And again, for all I'm a light-headed, fair person, it never seemed to affect me, the heat in the desert. I always cooked with that as well. In fact, one of the few things I got into trouble for was not wearing a topi, the sun hat.